Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
All right, it's great to be back here at Origins. Thanks for joining us, broadcasting live from the lobby of the Line Hotel here at Full Service Radio. Got some folks down from Baltimore today, or Baltimore area, to talk about farming, organic farming in the Baltimore food scene. And I guess you're making it down here to D.C. more and more often, right? Is that true?
Yeah, we come twice a week.
Great. So that's Emma Jagaz.
Yep.
And Jason James is here, both from Moon Valley Farm, one of my favorite farms up in our neck of the woods, and I'm glad you're making it to D.C. and seeing us here. And we caught you on a good day because it's raining outside. Nothing unusual about that this year, though, right? It's been a rough year.
Very wet year.
All the way around. And we'll talk about that a little bit first. I'd love to get into what you guys do. Is it crazy to call it a virtual farm? Maybe that's a little extreme. But you're farming in various sites, I guess you could say, S-I-T-E-S, around the county. Talk a little bit about your farm and what you're doing up there.
Sure. So our farm is located on several different sites in the suburbs of Baltimore County. We have a main site that I live on, and we have our pack shed and our high tunnels there, but we lease the rest of our land for growing our field crops. We currently lease 8 different properties, including our main site, and grow with our tractor, our walk-behind tractor, and various ways on that.
So how much land are we talking about?
We're talking about 12 acres that we have fenced in production.
Fenced in because?
Of deer pressure,
yeah. Yeah, got you. Man, there are a lot of deer out there, huh?
Yep.
And how long has it been going?
We just finished off our 7th season. I mean, we still have about 7 more weeks of our CSA, but our main season just finished. So we just finished 7 seasons and have been growing each one.
That's fantastic. And I want to talk a little bit about the model that you guys have landed on, which is focused, as I understand it, principally on CSA and restaurant sales.
Absolutely.
But first, because this is something we've talked about here at Origins a lot, I got to say it's great to have 2 young farmers here talking about this because, as you know, young and farmer isn't a word that you hear too often, or words you hear too often together. We've got a farming population that's kind of aging out, and there's general concern, and I think and also specific concern around, you know, who's going to be growing our food for the next generation. And you guys are younger than most of the 60-year-old kind of average. What got you into farming? I'd love to hear, Jason, if you want to talk about what got you into growing things.
Yeah, so I actually grew up as a farm brat. My family's been in agriculture for a really long time, but it skipped a generation. So nobody in my mom's era farmed. So I grew up around a farm.
Where was that?
Western part of Northern Virginia, Culpeper County. So just about an hour south of D.C.
And a working farm, what were they growing?
Cattle.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, it was a working cattle farm. It had been a lot of things over the years. And so hearing family stories, you know, I kind of got this picture of lots of different enterprises happening in a place. And that being what made a farm. Like, it wasn't always a cattle farm. They'd done, you know, different kinds of crops, different kinds of livestock. Always been trying to stay ahead of whatever the economic fortunes of farming were. And it was something that I grew up with a lot of appreciation for, but no sense that it was like an option. You know, nobody taught me that farming was a thing you could do. They taught me it was a thing to appreciate, but not something that was a viable way to make a living. And when I got older and, you know, went through college and some years of career and just other life stuff, I started taking a harder look at it and really came to it as a direct result of what Emma was doing. I mean, I saw what she had going on, and I felt like I had to be a part of it.
So let's hear the same thing from you, and then maybe we'll talk about that moment where Jason joined in and what happened since then. But first, what got you into farming?
So I started growing a vegetable farm when I was pregnant with my first child, because I really wanted to grow and eat a lot of arugula. I thought that I had read somewhere that it was going to make my baby smart, and so I just did it. I wanted more than I could afford at the grocery store, and I could afford a packet of seeds pretty nicely. So I grew some on first the deck of my apartment, and then in ground.
The obvious question is that does that work? Does that?
I have no idea. My kid's pretty smart, but but you know, I think it's up in the air. So I had a big organic vegetable garden, and then I had a baby, and then I had a second baby, and I really wanted to both raise my kids and work for myself. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. But most of the businesses I could think of that I wanted to start were either not really a great place to raise your kids, or they cost a lot of money to start and I didn't have that, or both. And I've always been really passionate about food. So I started really writing things down. What did I want to do with my life that I felt good about raising my kids while doing it. So I expanded on my vegetable garden and just decided to start a farm. I heard about the CSA model, and I thought that was perfect because I could have people come pick up at the farm. I could have my kids full time with me the whole time. I could put the food out for CSA and, you know, breastfeed in the kitchen if I needed to. So I started on about an eighth of an acre with a 12-person CSA while raising my less than one-year-old and two-year-old at the time. And the garden really grew from there.
So that was, you were farming on your kind of home base.
Yep.
And then talk to me about how there was a vision you had an idea though, which was, and this ties into something that I've always, a number that I read at some point, which was that the states, people always say like, do we have enough farms? Do we have enough farmland? And I was like, you know what? The United States has 37 million acres of lawn.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can fall back on that if we need to. And what you guys do is kind of related to that. And then you take kind of unused or underutilized or however you want it, maybe you have a better word for it, land and grow stuff. And
absolutely.
It turns out that you have a lot of people that think that's a cool idea. But talk about how you got on that.
The property that we started farming on is 2.5 acres, and we're now growing on about 0.5 acre of it. After my first season, I realized that I wanted to grow more things, even just for a 12-person CSA, to diversify their diet. So I wanted winter squash, and I wanted watermelons and more potatoes and crops that took up more space. And so I asked my next door neighbor if I could farm her yard as well. She said yes. And at the same time, one of my other neighbors who saw what I was doing recommended that I contact his brother-in-law, who had 27 acres, most of it wooded, but several acres that could be farmed just in Phoenix, Maryland, about a 20-minute drive. So I actually, the second year, I started farming all three of those sites for a 25-person CSA. This was a volunteer-run organization at that time. And when Jason started volunteering there as well, I think maybe that was the following year.
No, I was there a bit earlier than that.
Okay. So it's all kind of a blur now. Raising kids on the farm, it makes you tired and blurry. So from there, we kind of picked up sites as they came up, and we now farm on eight different sites in Phoenix and Baltimore or in Cockeysville, Maryland.
Which is a really cool thing, because if you talk to anybody about small scale farming in this country and this region, one of the things that constantly comes up, major barrier to entry and a huge issue for young farmers is getting on land, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
you guys have landed on this very cool answer to that. It might not be the final solution for you guys, but it's a very cool thing that's working for you, right?
Right. Yeah, most of the people are really interested in letting us farm their land because they don't want to mow it anymore. They were just mowing it. It cost them money. It cost them time. And they would rather see it used. A lot of the people in Baltimore County and in many counties around the United States, they really just don't have a productive use for their lawn.
Right. And the other thing you see a lot of times, people on some land in Baltimore County, for example, and they lease it out to commodity growers.
Yep.
And we just have this kind of insidious creep. And I'm just, you know, when you're out there right now, you see the corn and soy is kind of getting harvested and the land is all barren right now. And you, a day like this, and you know that a lot of that, those nutrients and chemicals are ending up in the Chesapeake Bay. So brief digression. I never fail to kind of look on the darker side of things. But so Jason, when at this point you kind of joined the farm, right?
Yeah, so I started helping Emma out when she was in her backyard and was there for those first transitions. And the thing that's kind of interesting about all these suburban properties that we're on is that they're all really ex-agricultural properties. You know, we've got both archaeological and sort of oral history evidence of at least two market gardens in Emma's neighborhood back in the 30s to the 50s. All the sites that we're on further north in the county have been farmed at some point in the past, but have kind of, you know, transitioned into being residential since then. And so, you know, we're not even really like branching out to some place that isn't farmland. This
right.
is just an older generation of farmland. And the point that really connected it for me when I was in college, I was writing a thesis paper about East Baltimore. And I went through this oral history project that the University of Maryland collected on the Orleans Street corridor. And somebody there talked about remembering in the 40s, farmers bringing produce on horse-drawn cart. And these aren't even like the Arabers that are around Baltimore today, but like coming straight from the farm. Down Pennsylvania Avenue. And I'm going, well, if they're bringing produce by horse down Pennsylvania Avenue, like how far away are they? I mean, a mile or two, right? You know, and the reality is that just 60 years ago, the majority of fresh produce that people in a city like Baltimore ate came from no further than our farm is, right outside of the city limits in what is today a residential suburb. So it really just all sort of clicked that like this is a big missing link in this whole local food puzzle is not bringing local in from 100 miles away, but bringing local in from the near urban space where you can maintain, you know, the utmost quality with quick delivery and real connection to the people that are eating the food.
You see, my phone is blowing up with Omer Beiler's. I'm sitting here talking to farmers. I got farmers calling on the phone. It's that's the and I want to say like one of the just I know we're gonna get into other stuff, but I wanted to bring up this moment where you guys were at Woodbury. It's one of my favorite. I walked in and you guys were shelling beans, and I think Jason had a baby on his back, and I took a bunch of pictures because I just thought it was. We have this crazy little bean sheller, and you guys
would like to use it next week, please.
Yeah, you got it, and just a. You know, Woodbury is still this kind of place where even I can walk in and be like, this is so cool. What's happening? I have nothing to do with this. And I just have this beautiful memory of you guys shelling beans and the kids are there. And so let's talk about the business of farming when it comes to Moon Valley. And that is, as you've told me, the CSAs that you've talked about. And I'd love to hear more about that because there are challenges around. I mean, CSAs are great. And for those that love them, I think they are perfect, but there are some challenges on the grower side and on the I can only imagine this year too. We should talk about that. And then I think a growth area for you, if you will, is restaurant sales, right?
Yeah. So we've been selling actually about 50-50 of our business to CSA and restaurants for the past 4 years. We've grown them both at the same time. This year we have a 200-person CSA that goes for 22 weeks, and then we have an additional 11 weeks of a spring and fall add-on that about half of our members choose to opt in for.
And how many are they at this point?
We have 200 or, you know, just under 100 in our extended season CSA.
200 all told and mm-hmm. 100 hang on for the...
Yep. Yeah, and then we sell to top chefs in Baltimore and D.C. And we sell to them year-round. Yeah.
And that's 50% of your sales?
About, yeah.
And what?
And then we sell to some... We do a smattering of wholesale to makers.
So what's the upside of CSA? Especially for folks who may not know. And you know, what's the upside for a customer of yours? And what's the upside for a grower?
Well, it's a really important tool for crop planning for a farm of our scale, that you've got a good sense of how many people you've got to provide for. And, you know, you can make those calls without taking into account the kind of vagaries of what's trendy on the restaurant scene, and know that you've got a good staple of crops that people are going to enjoy. So we'll start at the beginning of the year and say, okay, well, how much, you know, broccoli do we need in the spring for 200 people? And just sort of work out from there. So it's, you know, I guess it adds an element of predictability. It adds an element of planability.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the consumer, they're guaranteed to know their farmer, know their source, and be a part of a community that is otherwise really lost. You know, in this world, it's really important to maintain a sense of community somehow with somebody. And this is a chance for like-minded people to get together and say, hey, you know, we're more interested in supporting this small-scale organic farm than choosing what we eat every week, you know, instead of going to a market and saying, oh, no, I really just want carrots this week. You know, maybe they'll get beets and they'll try something new. A big perk that our CSA members say is that they try new things. They get out of cooking ruts. They feel inspired, and that the food tastes better.
So I keep referencing it. It is raining outside. We are, I think, an inch or two away from having had the rainiest year on record, 2018. It looks like it will go down as that.
Absolutely.
And I don't think folks recognize what that does to a farm and what that does to a farm business. And I want to connect it a little bit to CSA.
Jason, yeah.
You know, you talked about it being kind of that CSA has a measure of predictability, but then this wasn't nobody. Well, it's yeah. Weather can't be predicted. What's it been like? And, you know, it puts amazing. I can imagine it puts incredible stresses on the farm and the business.
Absolutely. So having a CSA is one of the reasons why our business has stayed afloat this season with their raft, and they gave us the oars because we have predictable income from them no matter how hard it rains. So we have people sign up. We're really flexible about how we accept payment. So we accept monthly payments from a lot of our members instead of a lump sum in the beginning. But either way, we can plan for how much money we're getting. And that secures our income, our loans, our, you know, just money. It secures that for us. Having a CSA has been really important for that in our business. Otherwise, the rain can affect our farm and does on all sorts of fronts. I mean, if we were just a market farm and we had to stand in a market and it rained every, you know, Sunday, or that could have really affected our sales more so. So having CSA as an outlet has been really important for us.
Yeah, farmers, I mean, in addition to the rain, it sounds like farmers markets are also struggling, and
right.
You know, probably connected to weather, because nobody wants to go out and shop in this, but also it seems like that model is also having its own challenges. All right, so let's talk about the top chefs that you alluded to, and what it's like to sell to restaurants, and why that became a part of Moon Valley's business.
Yeah, so I think the first point that we really talked about it was a year that Emma had a glut of tomatillos, and the CSA was getting really sick of them, and she's wondering.
I hear the phrase glut of tomatillos, and I think there's no such thing.
You can't
right. Yeah. So we came to that point and said, well, you know, like a restaurant can probably use like way more tomatillos than this. And it was sort of the first crop that really by accident the farm grew enough of to stretch beyond what the CSA could use. And we started with your restaurant. Woodbury Kitchen was a pretty easy entry for us. We knew some folks that were working there at the time.
One of our main volunteers was a full-time server for you.
Yep. And that connected the dots in a really easy way and, you know, gave us a foot in the door to start figuring that out.
So on the personal front, raising our kids on, so I have two kids on the farm, and raising them has been difficult for me to figure out how I would do a market, because I couldn't figure out childcare at the same time, but I could put them in their car seats and deliver to restaurants. So I felt like I could make that happen. So that's another reason logistically delivering to restaurants worked for me, you know, in the same vein that having a CSA did. You can continue.
Yeah, so we, you know, checked it out, and it seemed like selling to restaurants made sense. And we started looking. And at the time, you know, it wasn't clear that anybody was really buying produce from local farms. But we called people and we kind of just checked out what sort of food people were serving and said, hey, like we can grow that. Knocked on doors, walked into kitchens with samples, walked into kitchens with stuff for sale and an invoice book and put it together and, you know, eventually started getting, you know, more word of mouth referrals from chef to chef or following chefs when they leave one restaurant and go to another. And building up a good roster of excellent restaurants that are interested in getting at least part of their produce from a farm like ours.
Yeah, so now selling to top chefs is sort of different than the very beginning.
Yeah, definitely.
Now we'll custom grow some things, but we keep on some of the food trends. We grow really high-end product for chefs based on what they want and what's going on their menus, and then and vice versa, what goes on their menus is what's coming out of our fields. And so we sell twice a week to chefs in Baltimore and DC. Really, really great chefs.
Cool. Well, and who in DC are you selling to?
Trade secrets.
Yeah,
is it?
I don't know. we just came from Tail of Goat. Besides your kitchen here at Rakes, we sell to Maidon and Compass Rose. We just came from the Dabney. Those are some of the main folks in DC we sell to.
Those are some great places. And hopefully, it shouldn't be a secret that they're selling your produce or that they're using your produce and that you are.
Yeah.
And you're selling to them. That's great.
Yeah.
Awesome. What are you guys working on next? I think we've had some conversations. I mean, this is hard work. There's no other way to describe it. And it's, I talk to growers, and if you can't find a way, it seems to scale a little bit or to mechanize, you know, I've heard farmers say, I'm done picking cucumbers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of this stuff is just so hard, it becomes impossible.
Too hard.
Yeah, hard, exactly. Do you guys is there an idea of how Moon Valley goes from this very cool place to become something that's maybe easier for you or easier on you?
To be clear, it'll always be a really cool place.
All right. Yeah. Goes from being a cool place to... Yeah.
At a very basic level, we've got to raise the financial floor.
Yeah.
We have to make more money as a farm so we can employ more people to do more of the work, so we can mechanize more, both on the production side as well as the post-harvest side. And that's been an ongoing trend for years, is trying to professionalize things to get, you know, more appropriate equipment, to get better packing and handling facilities. Even since the last time you came to the farm, we put $7,000 or $8,000 into our pack shed, built another cooler, and built foundation for another cooler past that. And I think it's going to be a lot more of that.
Yeah, so we started a farm with really no money, and each year have put our profits into growing the farm. And so we've done that each season. We're going to continue to do that. We just got our first four-wheel tractor this season and plan to get a second next season so that more of our work is tractor-based instead of walk-behind tractor-based, which, like you said, is really hard on the body.
Yeah, or like shovel-based.
Yeah, so we're, you know, continuing each year to grow, and our vision for our future farm will be a bigger scale.
So does it seem, Jason, that you've gone, you talked earlier about the fact that this didn't seem, when you were younger and you were growing up on a farm, but for whatever reason, it didn't seem like an option. It didn't seem like this was going to be what I was going to do. And does that seem now for you too, that given your experience, what you say, 7 years now, that this is, you have it, there's a viable future for...
Yeah, it's entirely viable. I mean, it's our full-time income.
It's a viable income. Current.
Yeah. It's full-time income for both of us. You know, payroll goes through for our employees.
And how many are they?
It was five this season.
And are still volunteers helping out, or is it just...
Not really. We have some volunteers in our pack shed, but for the most part, we just have paid employees.
And one thing I will say for farmers that are listening, and... a little bit of advice, because I actually get to give a lot of advice, and most of it goes unheeded. But what you got, one little thing you guys did, which I thought was really smart, is you have an amazing logo and some really cool hats. And I think that was, who did, talk about your logo. And I mean, I don't,
sure.
I'm not being flip about it. It is actually very cool. And you have stickers.
Yeah, and I think branding is important.
Yes, good.
Yeah, so my sister happens to be a woodblock print and graphic design artist, so that has helped us enormously. She designed our logo and carved it out of a linoleum block. So we've always gotten comments on our logo, and I've always been excited to share that with people. By getting lots of stickers and handing them to people, by getting hats with the logo on it, and giving them or selling them to our best customers. So, yeah.
I
think branding is really important. Putting yourself out there is everything. You know, the most important part of a business is having customers and making sales, because without that, you're not a business. So we've just always been really excited to take that on.
Yeah, she made a poster for our CSA like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
That I actually still saw one hanging up at the beginning of this season. And I think it just looked so cool that nobody bothered to take it down. Yeah. And that's great. I mean, if the material you put out to promote your business and talk about your business looks like art, it sticks with people.
Do you still have a passion fruit bush on your farm?
Oh, we have like 1,000 because they reproduce
over the back
like crazy.
Are they? Is it set in fruit?
Mm-hmm. I ate a few this
How
year.
Are they?
They're very tart. They're really delicious. I don't like citrus on its own all that much, but my daughter loves it and will snatch up all the fruit and eat it herself.
So none to sell, because your daughter's eating them all.
Correct.
Oh,
sorry.
All right. When you get some more, let me know. I'm dying to. I couldn't believe when I saw that out there last time, and we'll get a hold of it when she gets her fill, I guess.
Yeah.
Ugly shares.
Yeah.
Are something that I've never heard before. I don't think. Check the urban dictionary. No, but what is that? How does that work for Moon Valley?
So our CSA offers full shares, part shares, extra large shares, and also ugly shares. A part of how we farm on multiple suburban sites is over harvesting, because it would cost us too much money to go back to a site to get another bunch of carrots than it would to pick an extra 2 or 3 bunches of carrots to ensure that we don't have to do that. So we over-harvest almost all of our crops by at least a couple of bunches. And then we realized that, well, we were hitting all our targets, we were filling all our boxes, but now we had all this extra produce. And what do we do with that? So we decided to make what's called an ugly share, not only for our extra produce, but for the produce that comes back from the, you know, it was picked in the field because it looks really nice, but then it got dinged up on the way back to the pack shed, or maybe it just, you know, isn't perfectly straight cucumber, or maybe it's like a really extra weird looking heirloom tomato or something like that. Well, we put it in the ugly shares. So at first, the farmers, like, I was, Jason and I were like taking all that stuff home, and but then we started growing way too much food for that. So we decided to offer a reduced priced share called an ugly share, where all that is aesthetically imperfect food goes. Sometimes it's just extra.
And I can get that for less?
Yep.
How much less?
We sell it for $15 a week. So it's about the equivalent to a part share box, where you get about 6 items in your box each week.
That sounds like a deal.
Yeah, it is a deal.
I'd love to go back to what the amazing point that Jason made about this idea of local. And one of the things that you hear a lot is that local food, I just had this conversation today, to be honest, and I'm a little tired of it. Maybe you can help, because you still hear that local food, the kind of food that you guys are growing, is too expensive. And you know, I love the connection that Jason made to the fact that, you know, this was done. This isn't, you know, this can feel kind of new, and your guys' approach is kind of cool and has, there's a kind of a new aspect to it, but it's also rooted in the way that we lived not so long ago.
Right.
But how would you respond to someone who's, I can't imagine they have the nuts to tell you that it's too expensive, but if
they definitely,
okay,
do.
Well, in that case, how do you respond to that? Because, well, I just would love to know.
Sure. So,
start
first
by
of all,
rolling up your sleeves.
First of all, I think our produce is very affordable. We should actually probably raise our prices across the board, because I think we sell our produce in reaction to that potential fear for too cheap. But, you know, how people spend their money is very subjective. I think a lot of people think that food should cost less because a lot of subsidized food is showing up for less. But I think most food that you see in grocery stores isn't reflecting the true cost of the food. It isn't reflecting a fair wage for the laborers that worked to get the food. It's not reflecting a fair wage for the fuel that carried the food across the country, or even across the world, in order to get to that grocery store. And it's not carrying a true cost for the production of the food because of subsidized agriculture and water and resources. So I would say that our food is on the cheap end for what it truly costs.
I think, you know, there's a point that a lot of times doesn't get talked about in that discussion, which is that there's no guarantee that cheap food is profitable for anybody who produced it. You know, stuff coming out of the sort of auction circuit, even stuff coming out of big wholesalers, you know, the Jessup Terminal or whatever, is often sold at a loss just to keep it moving. So there's this sort of assumption that food's got to be cheap, you know, whatever the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, it's not sustainable. And I don't mean sustainable in some, you know, sort of wishy-washy kind of undefined way. I mean, like, we can't keep it up. There will be a price to pay for that kind of cheapness. And we see it in both the loss of productive farmland and in rising rates of diseases associated with eating a lot of things that aren't fresh foods. And I think local has got to be a part of, if not the entirety of the solution to that. I think it's an amazing thing that we can move calories around the planet with surgical precision. It's one of the defining inventions of the 21st century. But to act like it's a you know, free gift is just willfully not paying attention to what it really costs to do that. And I think a lot of people are coming into this idea that, you know, what we do might not replace the grocery store for them, but it becomes a very important supplement to that for them. It becomes something that they really associate with, you know, the flavor of the food that they're getting and the healthful benefits of the food they're eating. And maybe to make their pocketbook work, they've got a shop at, you know, discount where they can, but often that's to make room to pay for the kind of produce that we grow because, you know, we're showing them what it's really worth.
Yeah, they say you either pay the farmer or pay the doctor.
And maybe the grocery store becomes a supplement to what you guys are doing.
Right.
You know, maybe you
right.
fill in the gaps with what you can't get from Moon Valley. Maybe you change what you're eating, too. I think that's one of the things is people yeah. are saying, like, I can't get X from a local farm. It's like, well, maybe you don't need X, you know.
Yeah.
But there's such a huge conversation that what I love is that you're pointing out things that are actually that are now a part of our world. I mean, we are confronting these realities now, these consequences, and we need to figure out a solution. So that you don't feel compelled. There's no downward pressure on price. Are you trying to make your food cheaper?
We're trying to make it more expensive, for
Good.
Sure.
How's that going?
It's going fine. You know, we haven't raised our CSA prices for several years because we were worried that, you know, people wouldn't keep joining our CSA. And there is a constant comparison with grocery store prices on our products elsewhere. So there is that awareness, but we just try to stay competitive within our local food scene instead of looking at commodity foods.
Well, I want to thank you guys for coming down to DC and for coming down twice a week, as you do, but for spending time here with us at Full Service talking about this. You know, a lot of times, as wrestling with what we call what we do, and it's one of the things that I've landed on is kind of community sourcing, because there's now, I think you could say, there's a community of growers and makers and brewers and you know, and that's, and you guys are the best, I think, example of that. I mean, you're in the community. You've kind of found this way to insert yourself into our little area up there, and that's really, really cool. Thank you for all that you do. Thanks for coming to Origins and talking to us.
Absolutely. And thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Have you back soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.